Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
Guess what? It's snowing. The pavements are deadly, the trains aren't working. What better way to fill the time than to take to your bed with a good book? You could start by working your way through the category winners for this year's Costa Prize. We'll be discussing them later in the programme. But first, with apologies to all those of you in places which have never known a blizzard, we'll be taking a look at snow in literature. To set the scene, here's my all-time favourite snow poem.
The room was suddenly rich, and the great bay window was spawning snow and pink roses against it, soundlessly collateral and incompatible. World is suddener than we fancy it. World is crazier, and more of it than we think, incorrigibly plural. I peel and portion a tangerine and spit the pips and feel the drunkenness of things being various. And the fire flames with a bubbling sound, for world is more spiteful and gay than one supposes. On the tongue, on the eyes, on the ears, in the palms of one's hands, there is more than glass between the snow and the huge roses.
That was Chris Moran reading Snow by Louis MacNeice. With me to discuss snow in all its cultural manifestations are Sarah Crown, editor of the Guardian Books website, and Charlie English, whose book The Snow Tourist was described by one reviewer as an enchanting tale of one man's search for snow, a report on the precarious state of our extreme climates, an evocative poem to lost childhood winters. Welcome, both of you.
Hi.
Okay.
First, Charlie, in your first chapter, you come up with a series of words to describe what snow means to you. They range from innocence, happiness, fun, and beauty to danger, loneliness, and death. Can you just talk a little bit about how you came up with these particular responses?
Sure. Well, I suppose they're all things that I've felt myself at one time or another while I've been travelling through snow for this book, or that I felt when I was a child and I used to play in snow. But they're also things that I've seen other people enjoy about snow or feel about snow. And, you know, when we get a great snowfall like this and my kids go out in the street and we sort of build a snowman, and I certainly feel the sense of happiness and innocence and fun that I write about in my book. And then I suppose danger and loneliness and death and beauty could be combined in one image, really. I mean, I remember a time when I was in Alaska and I went out into the territory and was standing in this valley called Thompson Pass, where you look around for 20 miles in every direction, everything is absolutely covered in snow and there is not another living thing there. And this gives you a great sense of yourself. You're the only living creature in the landscape, really, as far as you can see. So that brings you loneliness, but also a sense of reflection, really. It's a bit like being in a desert.
So now, part of one's accepted view of snow, because we live in a fairly temperate place, is from literature, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. Yes.
And so what were the formative books for you?
As I was growing up, I used to read cheap thrillers like Alistair MacLean and Ice Station Zebra, and that gave me a very strong feeling of being cold. I remember reading Jack London when I was quite a young boy and not quite understanding the milieu, but imagining the landscape that he describes, which is, of course, Alaska. And I projected Alaska basically onto North Yorkshire, where I was growing up, and painted all the rather smaller hills with white, and it was dark most of the time, and I found that all very evocative.
Let's go back right to the beginning. In a sense, our appreciation of snow and indeed of nature in general began with the Romantics. You have a very nice quote from Shelley writing to his friend Thomas Love Peacock in the book, don't you?
That's right, yeah. Shelley visited the Chamonix Valley and saw Mont Blanc, and he wrote to Thomas Love Peacock, I never imagined what mountains were before, the immensity of these arid summits when they burst upon the signs, a sentiment of ecstatic wonder, not unallied to madness.
So, Sarah, this is a really big statement, isn't it? It stands for all of us. We didn't imagine even what mountains were before.
Yes, well, this was the Romantics' whole thing, the idea of the sublime and the idea that these horrible, terrible things that were seen as obstacles and barriers and death zones, I suppose, really, could be beautiful and their horror could, you know, kind of literally make our hair stand on end, but in a sort of an ecstasy rather than fear. Although I guess the two things are tied together quite closely. And Robert McFarlane goes into it quite a lot in his book, Mountains of the Mind, in which he talks about this sort of our burgeoning appreciation of these sort of vast landscapes and particular mountains, in particular snowy mountains. And I suppose we still have it today with people like Joe Simpson writing about mountaineering and Everest and the idea of climbing. And that's where we've taken it off and we've kind of pushed it further up, sort of higher up. And that's where we have our sort of sublime landscapes now. We've just kind of moved them up the hill a bit, I suppose.
You talk a lot about the great age of exploration, don't you? All those Arctic and Antarctic people, dauntless, setting off across untamed landscapes.
Yes, I mean, they're great snow heroes in a way. Fridtjof Nansen is one of them who made an extraordinary crossing of Greenland, the first crossing of Greenland, which he did on skis. And he really showed the wider world that skis were a phenomenally good way of getting about on snow, and in the end led to popularising them so that they became a 20th century sport. But also, obviously, the Scott Antarctic expedition involved a large amount of snow, and absolutely Terry Garrard's account of the Scott expedition, and in particular this trip that he calls the worst journey in the world, where they go to find a penguin's egg.
Best title in the world.
It's the best title. And the expedition just gets worse and worse, and their tent blows away in the umpteenth gale that they face, and they have to cross all these crevasses without any implements. But miraculously, they come back and alive. And I mean, one of the snow memories I have from that book is, I think it's Wilson, who is an artist and who likes to sit out and paint the snow, and he tells Cherry that that snow's never really white. It always takes on the tone of the light that is around it, and that's something you can see in impressionist paintings of snow. They never paint snow as white. It's always slightly pink or slightly orange or touched by the light.
And that's also sort of true in literature, isn't it, that snow, we use snow as a metaphor for so many things because of its blankness and its inability to absorb what's around it, so it can be made to stand for whatever action is happening around it, I guess.
But there isn't now a wilderness in the sense that there was even when Scott was setting off for the Antarctic, is there? So there isn't the sense of the untamed snow piles, is there? Hasn't that perception moved to the oceans now?
I think you'd still say the Antarctic continent was pretty wild. I mean, obviously you can access it much more easily than you could then. But that and parts of Alaska and Siberia are still pretty much wilderness, I would say. And you could find it if you looked hard enough and if you travelled long enough.
And if there were writers sitting in it, writing about
yes.
it. So now, I was quite surprised to hear from your book that there was an ice age as recently as the 19th century.
Yes, so there was what they call the Little Ice Age, which began probably sort of 15th, 16th century and lasted up until the 19th century. And it's a fairly local phenomenon to the Northern Hemisphere and Europe in particular. But we had some very extreme winters during that period. The first very severe one was probably 1564-5, which is the year Bruegel painted his famous snow painting, The Hunters in the Snow, which is the first winter landscape, basically, and it launched a whole series of artists on painting winter. And the Little Ice Age affected art in quite a major way, and you can almost track the temperature of winters through the amount of winter landscapes that people produced around that time, because obviously they wanted the source material to be in front of them. And for 100 years or so after 1565 in the Netherlands, the winters were very, very cold, and there was this big boom in winter landscape painting. And then temperatures rose a little bit. And then towards the end of the 18th century, cold started to come back. The 1810s were one of the coldest decades ever. And during that time, a great deal of snow painting was produced as well. So you have artists like Turner producing a lot of avalanche and snow-related art.
And in the 19th century, there is a lot of snow in the novel, isn't there?
Yeah.
More snow than we would experience in a normal year, isn't there?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I suppose Dickens is the first person that you think of in that context. And obviously there's the Christmas Carol, which is, the snowy, wintry scene. But then also there's Old Curiosity Shop.
Little Nell.
Yeah. And her...
Who could forget her?
Much as we may try. Yeah, she's... And her death, which is... snow related. And also, if you look at even books written about that time, there's a sort of, I was thinking about Rose Tremaine's book, Music in Silence, which is written, set in the past in Denmark. I think, is it Denmark? Slightly forgotten now. But it gets all about the cold and the snow and the, kind of endless winter.
And I mean, out of this comes, there are several different moods that come out of this, aren't there? You've got the sentimentality of Dickens,
yeah.
But you've also got death.
Yes.
No, I mean it's an abruption of life, isn't it? Which comes out quite a lot in the literature of that period. I mean, you think about Hardy, for example, barren, snowy Flint Camash in Tess of the D'Urbervilles, or the scene of the pig sticking in the Mayor of Casterbridge, where the pig's blood is splattered on the white.
And then you've also got Frankenstein. And one of the ones that I just remember this before, one of the ones that I used to read and reread quite a lot as a kid was in Lorna Doone, when it was the first time I'd ever come into contact with the idea of snowshoes. And as far as I could tell, they were kind of like tennis rackets stuck to your feet and you kind of walk over the snow in these kind of ridiculous shoes. And I really couldn't picture them as a sort of a child of the 1980s. But yes, it was definitely, when you read those sort of novels, and they're often the novels that you're reading as a sort of a child as well, moving on to kind of grown-up literature. Snow absolutely everywhere.
Mm. There's a great Dickens fact, actually, that I picked up along the research of this book, which is that six of his first nine winters in London were white Christmases, effectively. Yeah. So that goes some way to explaining why he put so much snow into his books, which we don't.
And also, I suppose, why we're so obsessed with the idea of a white Christmas as well, since the idea of Christmas generally is a Dickensian one, our idea of it, and if he paints it as a snowy scene, then that's what we expect from our Christmases.
Yeah.
But now, if you go to somewhere like the literature of Tolstoy, Russia, or Dr. Zhivago, or the literature from Scandinavia, icing snowiness can actually completely affect the pacing of a narrative, can't it? It's not just pretty.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose one of the great recent books in which snow played a huge part and hugely affected the course of the novel was James Meek's book, The People's Act of Love, which is all set off in Siberia. And snow becomes the reason why people can't get in and out of places. It stops people moving around, and therefore it causes some of the really sort of fairly gruesome things that go on in the book. It's directly as a result of the climate, the weather that the book's set in. And I also think a book that I always think of when you're talking about the way in which snow kind of forms a plot or informs a plot is Laura Ingalls Wilder's book, The Long Winter, which is about, I think it's about the seventh in her series of, Little House in the this, that and the other. And it's about when the family moves from the prairie into the town to survive what they know is going to be a very, very long and hard winter. And the town just kind of gradually shuts down and they can't get in or out of it. So you have this kind of community that's cut off from everywhere, and the food starts to run low. And it ends up being that these two brothers, one of whom Laura eventually goes on to marry, decide they've got to make a break for it. They've got to leave the town. They've got to get over the prairie to get some wheat. So they start this kind of quest, travelling across the prairie, and then they make it back, and then they celebrate Christmas. And again, then you have that injection of Christmas into the middle of this snowy land, and it's the sort of the joy in the middle of the wilderness, I suppose.
So that American obsession with the white Christmas.
Yeah.
I know it from carol services, so many carol services. Anyway, Sarah, this is a really big theme in poetry, isn't it? We opened with the Louis MacNeice snow poem.
Yeah.
It comes up again and again in contemporary work as well.
Yes. One of the great poems of Snow from recent years, I think, is Sean O'Brien's collection, The Drowned Book, which won the Foreword and the T.S. Eliot Prize, both in the same year, which is pretty unheard of. It's all, the whole book is about water and the movement of water, and even when it's very sluggish, it's all life in motion, I suppose. And then right at the end of the book, I think it's possibly, if it's not the last poem, it's the penultimate one. It's this poem called Blizzard, where suddenly just everything stops and all of the movement of the book stops, and you have this incredibly beautiful sort of imagistic poem of snow. And it's very metaphorical about, you know, kind of the idea of snow and what snow is freighted with, the meaning that we give to it. And one of the things that you were talking about earlier, Charlie, about the idea of climate change, is something that he says that with snow being so blank, it kind of absolves our guilt in a way. And you know, everyone, when it snows, go, oh, you know, start denying climate change. And he kind of brings this into his poem and begins it. The snow will bring the world indoors, the fall that saves the Gulf Stream and the Greenland Shelf. And this idea of snow is blotting out our guilt and getting rid of our sin. And it's a really wonderful poem.
Absolutely. Lastly, let's come to the idea of snow as evil, because this is the one that really fascinates me. It's the one that got me, you know, that it comes from my childhood. Those, you know, the being with Edmund on the Snow Queen's sleigh going through Narnia. Talk a bit about that.
Well, I think the great book of evil snow from my childhood was the second book in Susan Cooper's The Dark is Rising series. It's the eponymous book in the series, The Dark is Rising. And it's set around Christmas. And the plot of the book is that the dark, the evil, attempts to work its will by bringing down just blizzards and blizzards of snow on the south of England, much as we're seeing in the present time. And it becomes this kind of horrible, threatening. She sort of anthropomorphises it to a great extent. You know, it's trying to get in and it's putting out fires, and it becomes this kind of really sort of dark, threatening thing. And it's really brilliant. It's, you know, if you haven't read it, everyone should.
Charlie, you have a whole chapter of your book which is devoted to evil, isn't it? The evil element, you call it.
That's right, yeah.
And it's particularly good on avalanches. I didn't know about this avalanche law.
Avalanches, yeah. I mean, I guess snow in its most dangerous form is an avalanche. And there is a kind of old myth about avalanches that runs back through Alpine history. And people used to think avalanches were caused by witches. And people used to cite witches flying down an avalanche on a log, spinning her wheel. And there's a case of this from one of the Swiss cantons where this poor, unfortunate old lady was dragged off and murdered by four men straight afterwards. And people used to bury eggs with crosses on them at the foot of known avalanche slopes in order to try and ward off the evil that would befall them.
There's a lovely line you quote, which is from Colin Fraser, avalanche historian, you said. I don't know of him.
It's a small field.
Which goes, what flies without wings, strikes without hand, and sees without eyes. That's really scary, isn't
the answer,
it?
The answer is the avalanche beast.
Yeah. The avalanche yeah. beast. I mean, any number of mythological conjurations could come from that, couldn't it? Now, let's come up with, for people who are listening, let's come up with our 10 top. We love lists, don't we? We've said this before. Let's come up with our 10 top snow books.
Okay, well, should we keep going round?
Yes.
I definitely say The Long Winter by Laura Ingalls Wilder would be, that's the real one that I remember from being a child and reading about snow. So that would be on it for me.
Okay, Charlie?
Well, I think you'd have to have some Jack London in there, and I would probably nominate The Call of the Wild.
Okay, I'm going to be obvious and go for Christmas Carol, because we've got to have some Dickens in there.
Okay.
The one.
All right, then back to Russia. We mentioned Dr. Zhivago before, so that would be on there, Dr. Zhivago by Boris Pasternak.
I'll be extremely obvious and go for Raymond Briggs's The Snowman.
That's a good one.
Cozy one, yeah, that's it. Right, I'm going to go for James Meek's The People's Act of Love, which is set in this, it gives you a real sense of the immensity of the Russian steppes.
Yeah, okay, me again. Right, definitely you've got to have The Dark is Rising, as I believe I may have mentioned already.
Right, that's the sixth.
I'll go for Miss Schmiller, which I think has wonderful descriptions of the different types of snow.
That's Miss Schmiller's feeling for snow.
Yeah.
which of course, there's a chapter in your book which is about the myths of the all the different words for snow and things.
There is a little section about the Inuit snow hoax, as it's been characterised, which essentially is that, I mean, everyone's heard that the Inuit or the Eskimo have 100 or 300 or however many it is words for snow. In fact, this isn't true, sadly. They have rather fewer than that.
Never mind. Right, my next one is going to be Cherry, which is the biography of Apsley Cherry Garrard by Sarah Wheeler. I'm not actually going for his book itself. I'm going for the biography.
Good choice.
One more?
Four. Probably Annie Proulx's The Shipping News. That's a kind of a good sort of a good story.
With its iceberg prisons.
Yeah,
it's a very good one. And of course, I'm going to round this off by going first Charlie English's The Snow Tourist, which is published by Portobello. If you're snowed in or your local borders are shut, you can order it and most of the other books we've mentioned at guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Now, as far as I recall, there's not much snow in any of the category winners of this year's Costa Awards, though there is one very cold New York winter in Colmtoy Beans, Brooklyn. Sarah, will you just run us through the winners?
Yes, well, you've mentioned Brooklyn, Colmtoy Beans' novel, which won the novel category in this year's Costas. The biography category was won by Graham Farmilow for his book The Strangest Man, which is biography of this quantum physicist Paul Dirac, which Claire, I guess he can tell us a bit more about later. Patrick Ness won the Children's Book Award for the second part of his trilogy, I think, The Ask and the Answer. Raphael Selborne won the first novel award for his book called Beauty, and Christopher Reed won the poetry category for his collection A Scattering.
Now, Brooklyn fell out of the bookers at the shortlist stage.
This has been the main talking point of the Costa so far, I think, is that Brooklyn wasn't shortlisted for the Booker, to much horror and indignation. And then it was shortlisted for the Costas, and lo and behold, it's actually won. It beat Wolf Hall, which was also shortlisted in the Costas.
But Wolf Hall was never going to win this,
I don't
was
think
it?
So. I mean, it would have been a real surprise. I think that, you know, it's not unfair to say that the Costas try not to follow the Booker with their novel winner. And they are there. I mean, you look at the list, the shortlist and the winners of the last few years, and they are actually, I think, looking at a slightly different audience than the Booker. I think it's, yeah, again, I'd say it's probably not unreasonable to say that they're slightly less literary.
I'd say that Brooklyn is incredibly literary.
Yeah, no, I'm not. I don't say that Brooklyn isn't literary. It clearly is, and as is Wolf Hall for that matter. But if you look more generally at the shortlistings over the last few years, I think the focus of the award is different. Mm. And possibly that's why Brooklyn, while it's a beautifully written book, it's a story that's simply told. It's something that people can read quickly and easily and just enjoy on a storytelling level as well as on a literary level. And I think that that is something that appeals to the judges and audiences of the Costa.
Mm, it's, of course, about emigration to New York from Ireland in the sort of time of the Second World War. Now, it is at least short, isn't it?
Yes,
unlike
it is.
The Ask
unlike
and the Answer. The winner of the children's section. Tell us about this.
That's a very substantial novel.
Part of this tradition of great, big, long-running, multi-part
children's books. Yeah.
Epics, really, isn't
it? Yeah, these big trilogies or big sort of multi-part serials in children's literature are very popular at the minute. Pache, J.K. Rowling, among others. And Philip Pullman is someone who won Costa or Whitbread, as it was back then, for the third book in his trilogy, The Amber Spyglass. So, yes, they have a history of liking
the book. Is it usual to win one for the second part of a trilogy?
Well,
it seems rather odd to me.
I
have to say, got in first with the Guardian Children's Fiction Prize. We gave him the prize for the first one.
OK, well, here's my tip then to anyone who's thinking about betting. I would say that because it's the second book in a trilogy, it's probably unlikely to win the Costa of Costas or the overall Costa Prize. And so, yeah, I wouldn't be putting any money on it.
OK, so now let's come to the first novel, which is Beauty by Raphael Selborne.
Yes, this is the story of a young Bangladeshi woman who's on the run from her family, I suppose, sort of slightly in the tradition of things like Brick Lane, books like that, the sort of the expat experience. It's published by Tyndall Street Press, which is a small Birmingham imprint, and did very well with Catherine O'Flynn a couple of years back, and is somebody they've become quite a player now in the publishing scene. So this will be really good news for them. And it's a book that didn't make it onto the Guardian's first book award shortlist, because often that will play out quite strongly in the costas, but has had a lot of good reviews and yes, by all accounts, it's a very good book. Mm-hmm.
Now, a book that did make it onto the Guardian list is The Strangest Man by Graham Farmelow, which won the biography section. This is a biography of, indeed, the strangest man of science, Paul Dirac, who's a would probably now be thought of as autistic, one of that group of scientists who sort of formulated 20th century physics, basically.
And this is very interesting because I haven't read this book yet, and it wouldn't be a book that, you know, a biography of a physicist who was sort of socially not very capable, probably not a book that I would be jumping to pick up from the shelf. So why is it good? Because obviously know it very well.
I'm really interested that it's on the costas, particularly in the light of what you said about it being a populist prize, because this has some really crunchy science in it. Even our science boys felt it was a little bit uncompromising. Why? I suppose it's one because it's such an amazing story. And it is one of the... It is also a biography that will never be written again. And you very rarely get a sense of biographies that should be written. They're filling in a part of a historical jigsaw. There's an awful lot of it is pulling away at the hem of history.
Yeah.
It's the wives and the mistresses and people who didn't really have a big part. And this is an absolute glaring absence in the history of 20th century science, which has now been filled. Anyway, that's enough about The Strangest Man. Last but not least, let's come to A Scattering by Christopher Reed.
Yeah, now this is the one that I would if I was going to put any money on it.
This is the Poetry Prize
winner. Yes, this is the Poetry Prize winner. And I think that it has been such a long time since poetry has won the overall prize at the Costas or Whitbreads, as they were. In fact, it's not since Seamus Heaney won with Beowulf, and that wasn't, you know, it was in the poetry category, but it was breakout poetry, I suppose you might want to call it.
As was Ted Hughes' Birthday Letters,
yes, exactly.
Which was another one.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. They had a sort of a wider interest. But this, I think, it's a really good collection, but it has that sort of accessibility in that it's about bereavement. It's about Christopher Reed's the loss of his wife. It's very beautiful and also an experience that people can very readily identify with, and which therefore I think has a sort of once more has a wider application than perhaps just a collection of poetry that about more general themes. So I think this could be poetry's year, and I'm going to put some money on Christopher Reed winning.
Do you think it's an important prize, the Costa now? I mean, there was some talk about it not being so good as it when it was the Whitbread. I could never quite understand why a change of name should make a difference, but there you go.
I know. Changing from beer to coffee, isn't it, I suppose?
I think it's a move up of the evolutionary ladder, definitely.
Yeah. I think that commercially it's a very important prize. It's up there with the Booker in terms of changing the course of authors' writing lives. They win a really good chunk of money when they win, and it makes a huge difference to sales. And it's a prize that the media pays attention to, that will be covered extensively. And yeah, I think it is an important prize, actually. I think it's important that prizes like this are around and that they're drawing our attention to what's happened in the last year. Also, the fact that it happens at the end of the year or even the beginning of the following year means that what it does in a literary sense is to reflect back over what's happened in the last year, which is just interesting. It's a good moment to pause and think about what we've seen.
When we're all snowed in.
Yes.
The overall winner of the 2010 Costa Prize will be announced on January the 26th.
Yeah, and then we can see if I got it right or not.
It'll be bumps for you, Sarah Crown. It usually is when poetry's tipped. And that's it for this week's podcast. Thanks to Charlie English, Sarah Crown and Chris Moran for that reading. I'm Claire Armistead. The programme was produced by Ian Chambers. Goodbye.